When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 30, Episode 10. Coming up on the show, we've got brain-free consciousness, killer panpsychism, and the experiment to send Italians back to the 1980s. I'm your host, Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
Why do we want to send Italians back to the 1980s?
Because that's where they belong. No, it's an experiment. It's a psychology experiment.
Oh, I see.
It's okay. It's called the counterclockwise experiment. It's mentioned in a new book I'm going to be covering today from Ellen J. Langer, who's considered the mother of mindfulness.
Okay.
And she did this experiment in the 1970s where she took old guys and said, okay, you're going to have a week off your life and we're going to set you up in a beautiful resort, except it's going to be the 1950s for you.
Oh, I would do anything for that.
Yeah, and she made it. Like the 1950s.
How cool would that be?
So they rolled up in 1950s cars. The music playing was all from the 1950s. The magazines, the newspapers available were all from the 1950s. Even on the television, it would be a broadcast of what you would see from the 1950s. And essentially what she was trying to see is if these men who were in their, you know, 60s and 70s, if she took them from 1979 and made them believe it was the 1950s, that they would feel 30 years younger, nearly 30 years younger. So they did this. They had them stay in this place for a week, and then she did a battery of tests on, you know, their physical aptitude, on
like
their
grip strength and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, on their IQ, on their reaction time. And incredibly, all of them exceeded the baseline physiological results. Yeah, their grip strength was tighter. They had more strength. They had more mental sharpness. Their IQ went up. It was like they had gone back in time and were younger men all of a sudden.
So walking down the path of nostalgia somehow revitalizes the chemistry of the body? Is that what is implied here?
It's all about perception.
Right.
It's that whole fake it till you make it kind of idea.
Yeah.
But if you feel younger, if you act younger, you start to feel younger and your body responds. And this has been really the core of her research for decades now. She's been looking at how the mind influences the body. Now, of course, when you think of that, you think of the placebo studies, all these psychology studies, many of which we've spoken about on previous episodes. But this really caught my eye because she's really has been at the forefront of this kind of experimentation and this kind of thinking that has been missing in the West for like 1,000 years.
Yeah. I mean,
you can go back to Descartes and the ancient Greeks all thought this way, that the mind was separate to the body. Whereas in the East, as we know, for a long time, it's been more holistic. So she's been leading this charge to kind of rethink this unity between mind and body, and experiment after experiment show you can change your body by changing your mind.
So I take it it's not just simply about, you know, looking at things nostalgically. It's actually like, obviously, remembering your past. Is that why she would base it in the 50s? Like, does it have to work in that fashion?
That's just one experiment. She does a whole bunch of things about essentially the psychology and how it affects your body.
Mm.
Like, one example I'll cover later on in the show is the cues you get from clothes, which is a funny one, probably applies more to women than it does to men. But, you know, especially with women's clothing, they've got like young person store and like older women's store. It's the same with men, I guess, but there's a cue that, oh, you can't be wearing a miniskirt anymore because you're too old for that, right? So she talks about this study they did where they adjusted for lifestyle and income and health status and all that sort of stuff. And they realized that something like uniforms, for example, doesn't have that kind of mental cue. Like when you're wearing a uniform at work, it doesn't have a cue of, oh, this is for a young person, this is for an old person.
Yeah, there's no preconceived kind of ideas about it.
It's just everyone wears the uniform.
Yeah.
And they did this long study. They looked at all this data and they realized that people that wear uniforms all the time live longer.
Really?
And the thinking is, because if you're wearing like...
Not if you're in the military.
Well, if you're wearing an old lady's dress, right, you look like...
You feel
the
old.
The cue is, I'm an old lady. I'm wearing old lady's clothes.
Right? Yeah, right.
So the mental cue is, you're old. And when you get old, you decline and you die. But when you're wearing a uniform, it doesn't have that same implication. So what the science, they say, is telling us is that because you don't have that thinking, your body doesn't age as if you were wearing an old lady's dress that keeps telling you you're an old lady. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Absolutely. You know why? I mean, there must be a limit to it, though, obviously. Like, you can't wear a diaper and just be like, oh my God, I'm back in my 20s.
Well, apparently people can these days.
Well, that is true.
What have you got coming?
Well, I'm going to go down the same kind of path, actually, because we're talking about scientific studies. I want to look into this new book called Threshold, which examines the incidence of terminal lucidity. And terminal lucidity basically is this phenomenon which has been popping up throughout medical history for as long as we can possibly imagine, but it's always dismissed. It's been seen by physicians and caretakers and, you know, people in the medical industry, but it's always this outlying kind of thing where all of a sudden somebody recovers their strength. And there's this old idea that, you know, and people have put a whole heap of ideas around, you know, why it occurs. It's like, well, it's based on a reptilian brain kind of thing where if you're about to die, somehow your body releases a whole heap of hormones and chemicals and cytokines that allows you to be able to get back to the cave, you know, that kind of thing.
That old chestnut. It's all chemicals in the brain.
Oh, I don't buy any of that. In fact, you know.
It's electricity in the neurons.
Yeah. So these people, there's these incidences where, you know, and particularly some of the research that I'm going to go into focuses on the 18th and 19th century, where it was more readily reported for whatever reason. It was actually put into literature. But in 20th century literature, there's like one or two reported incidents of it. And yet for Alexander Bethany, he points out, and this is the guy that wrote the book Threshold, he points out that after, because he's been working in, you know, psychical research for quite a long time, I think he's with SPR, has been involved with SPR,
right.
But he's a psychologist and working in this field. But he's pointing out that when he started putting out similar stories like ELE experiences, end-of-life experiences, people started contacting him with these experiences that are kind of similar, but he realized that they are terminal lucidity experiences. And these are where people somehow, when they're right at the verge of death, but they've been incapacitated for days, weeks, even sometimes years, they suddenly have this spontaneous recovery where the old person, the old ego comes back.
Really?
And they wish everyone well, and, you know, they put their affairs in order and they do these sorts of things that, you know, almost impossible, because you find out later on that their brain is completely destroyed. So I'm going to go into, because it crosses into the idea
completely destroyed. Just nothing there, an empty cavity.
I'll explain it later on, but from a medical perspective, an anatomy kind of perspective, yes, absolutely. It's not just mental illness, it's actual total destruction of brain tissue. These people shouldn't be able to behave in this fashion.
Have you got the stories of the guys who, you know, they do like an MRI scan and they realize they've just got a sliver of neural tissue?
Yeah, that actually comes up only briefly in the book, but that's
it's like this.
It's hydrocephaly.
Yeah,
hydrocephaly, where the brain is just full of fluid and there's this like very, very thin layer of brain, and yet somehow the person has an extremely high IQ.
They're totally
normal. They function completely normal. They had no comprehension at all that their head was just full of liquid, and they don't know. So what this starts crossing into is the factor of non-local consciousness, the idea that the brain is a receiver of information, a television signal perhaps coming from somewhere else, and that the brain just simply interprets the information, and that's how your soul, I suppose, comes through into this meat suit. But I'm going to go a little bit further. I'm going to go into the idea that I would like to coin inorganic non-local consciousness.
What?
And that is where there is no biology required at all.
Oh, so it's like a piece of wood has a mind.
It kind of crosses...
Like panpsychism.
It kind of crosses into panpsychism, yeah. So, but these people that essentially, because they have no brain, the filter idea is just ridiculous because the filter hasn't broken down. The filter is gone.
Hmm.
And yet the original person comes back through. And then also you have implications of people suggesting that they've been in like a dreamlike state. There was one woman in a couple of these cases that I went into, well, there's similar reports, but the overarching kind of idea this woman described is that she'd been in a coma for like 8 years or something and totally destroyed by some type of neurological...
Envious.
Oh, I know, right? But totally destroyed by some type of neurological disaster, essentially, which had, you know, become her. And her brain tissue was ruined, like absolutely ruined. And it was, you know, calcified and a whole heap of stuff. Essentially, machines were keeping her alive. And she remained in this state for about 8 years. And all of a sudden she came out of it and she came out to apologize. But when she came out to apologize, right?
She came out to apologize.
She came out and it was just, and with terminal lucidity with these cases.
Well, sorry for being in a coma.
No, sorry, because what, before she'd gone into the coma, right? Just before she got into the coma, she'd obviously had some type of Alzheimer's or dementia, you know, breakdown where she started becoming extremely aggressive, punching people, you know, doing bad things to people, and then went into this total catatonic state. But she came out of it and she was apologizing for her behavior all these years ago, right? So first of all, how did she recall that? But the next thing is, which is really incredible about this, is she starts saying that she's sorry because she's been in a dreamlike state. Like she felt like she'd been in some dream.
I still don't understand what she's apologizing for.
Something else came through. There was like something else while she was, just before it happened, almost like, and it's not said, right? It's not the term that's used, but I take it, that another consciousness came in and kind of pushed her out of the way. And that's why she was in the coma. She was fighting this thing.
Oh.
As it came through, and essentially it wasn't able to fully manifest, so she ends up in a coma. Like, it's strange. And so is there some type of physical result of spirit possession where spirit possessions don't actually work and it destroys the filter? Is that what's occurring with this kind of stuff? Like, there's so much stuff to unpack that we'll go into a little bit later on.
Yeah, very cool.
But also then later on in the plus extension, I want to go into cases of where this inorganic, non-local consciousness actually applies to the concept of panpsychism, but in very negative ways, where people are chased by their cars, runaway trains, haunted dolls that try to kill you in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
All kind of stuff.
Well, I've got a beef with our video capture card at the moment and it keeps losing frames and I don't know why.
I know.
And I keep yelling at it, calling it the N-word over and over and it doesn't seem to fix it.
What?
Maybe I should try a different tack.
Well, this is actually the thing, right? This actually comes up in this whole panpsychism idea, is that if you treat a machine, right, a machine badly, because it potentially, in the idea of panpsychism, could have a consciousness, if you're calling extremely horrible words, it's not going to respond in a happy way and potentially could kill you, Ben.
Yeah, but that's because it didn't listen to me when I was being nice to it.
It doesn't matter.
I changed tactics.
It doesn't matter. There was a guy that was actually killed by a supercomputer when this happened. I'm not kidding.
What, it just fell over onto him?
It electrocuted him.
Oh, my God.
But that will come up later.
Okay. Well, we've got big news to cover before we get into that. And, of course, the headlines this week. Mexican government reveals alien bodies. Mm-hmm. Mexican government, alien disclosure. You saw all these ridiculous headlines.
I ignored it.
And I saw this and I just thought, how short are people's memories? Because I see Jaime Maussan come out in front of the Mexican politicians and roll out these mummies we saw from 2017. Here's the story. World reacts to 1,000-year-old alien corpses unveiled in Mexico. UFO specialists, scientists, and NASA have responded after two non-human corpses were displayed to the world this week for the second time.
Yeah,
because they were displayed to the world in 2017. Ryan Graves, an executive director of Americans for Safe Aerospace, was among witnesses who testified before the Mexican Congress on Tuesday when the two mummified corpses were showcased to politicians. Mexican journalist and ufologist Jaime Maussan presented them during the country's first ever UFO hearing as proof of non-human beings. I got a bit of video here of the local coverage. We saw some Australian coverage of this. Let's take a listen.
Oh, no.
At a UFO hearing in Mexico, lawmakers have been shown what are claimed to be the corpses of mummified aliens. The two specimens in tiny coffins were presented before Congress by UFO researcher Jose Mosen. Bodies with shrunken and warped heads shocked the Mexican committee.
We should say that we're laughing because it's Jaime Maussan, not Jose Mosen. It's like the Aussie newser is like, yeah, Jose Mosen.
To be fair, close enough, he probably did better than what I would have if I didn't know his name. So I'll give him that
close
one.
Close enough.
It's a very Australian thing to do.
Pretty close.
Mosen claims the bodies were found in the Peruvian desert in 2017.
Yes.
And he believes they are around 1,000 years old.
It's the queen of all evidence. If the DNA is showing us that they are not human beings and that there is nothing that looks like this in the world, we should take it as such. They are non-human beings.
Do you know what's even more incredible is the fact that Maussan is still alive.
Like, yeah, he's still going. If you've been listening to this show for a while, you'll know we've covered Maussan over the years, especially in the early years of the show. But this has been around for a long time. As I said, Gaia did a documentary on these things, back in 2017. You can go to Gaia.com and just search for Nazca and you'll find what it's like, a 10-part series.
Mm.
I've got a few clips from the documentary. And again, let's take a listen to this again.
We get a lot of leads here at Gaia regarding new discoveries or investigations, but one particularly interesting lead came to us from a journalist named Jaime Maussan.
My name is Jaime Maussan. I am an investigative journalist, and I've been working as a journalist for the last 47 years of my life.
He got word of some mummies in Peru that didn't look human.
They look paper mache.
Peru and examine and see if these were fake or real or what were they. Our crew jumped on an airplane and flew from Colorado to Lima, Peru with cameras and everything in tow. Jaime also took a camera crew with us. We also took scientists.
And we have a very important mission here in Peru. I came here together with a group of scientists, professionals, journalists.
Once the scientists arrive, the body is revealed and they get to analyze it for the first time.
When he brought it out and pulled it out of the box, it was a stunned silence at first.
It was.
So that's the original one. Remember this
one? Yes, I forgot about that one.
This looks like
the absurdity of it.
Well, this looks like Peruvian mummies.
Yes,
it's in the same position. Except it obviously has three fingers and kind of looks like an alien. Let's keep listening.
The size of this humanoid was 168 centimeters. It's practically my size, a little bit shorter. So it means that this was a person who was walking as we do, who was able to move hands as we have, with long legs. So proportion of the body was very similar to ours. It is absolutely authentic hand with three long fingers, very long.
So what's intriguing about this is that original one, they kind of forgot about it.
Mm.
And they started to focus on these two smaller things.
These minioids.
Right. And I don't know why. It's almost like the original mummy was too easy.
Too obvious.
Too obviously a fake. So they had to switch focus on these. And in the Gaia documentaries, it's about five episodes in, they just start talking about these things. And it just gets so bizarre. Like, and this was rolled out at the Mexican presentation on Tuesday as well.
Why now? Why did they have to bring them out now?
I don't know what. Well, I don't know what the timing is. There's probably a new documentary deal or something
out. How do you even get before? What was it? A senate or what? What was this? It's not parliamentary.
It just says Mexican politicians.
Okay, so how do you manage to get an audience with a bunch of Mexican politicians?
You promise them eggs.
The team takes the bodies to get X-rays with the help of Dr. Edson.
First, from the physical exam, we reviewed that in the pelvic cavity there was a bump. So we are thinking many things, such as maybe it's last meal, or maybe something else, or maybe a gestation. We're going to take two X-rays. First a frontal X-ray, and then a lateral X-ray.
And then we went and we saw how the X-rays were taken. And what we found was that this creature had eggs inside.
In the pelvic cavity, we see the presence of eggs.
Uno, dos, y tres.
Incredible.
Looks like the way they transport cocaine.
It's so ridiculous. It really looks like a Rex Gilroy plaster cast of an alien he found. Like it really is so absolutely ridiculous.
It is ridiculous, but they have gone to a bit of effort, obviously, to create an internal skeletal structure. But that's not a hard thing to do.
But look how silly it is. They do a CT scan with this thing. It's like having a little Muppet and putting it in a CT scan machine.
Look how abruptly as well how the...
Go on.
Well, if you look at that X-ray image, right? Like, I'm no radiographer, but if you look at human bones, we have like these little round points on the end of our bones, and that's so that the tendons and ligaments and all that kind of stuff can attach to the bone, right? You've got these insertion points. If that, it's just completely flat.
Yeah, I'll get to that in a moment. Let's see the CT scan
in Russia.
Very important was analysis of X-ray and CAT scan, because again, it was done by a group of top level
scientists, researchers, doctors, medical doctors, who are doing thousands of this type of analysis for human, for people. And of course, they are top level specialists.
You've said that already. Yeah, that's all this guy tends to say, is that everyone involved is top level and it's all these scientists and officials. And I just saw this being rolled out and just thought, what is wrong with people? Can't you, like, obviously this is hilariously, this is ridiculous.
It is ridiculous.
You're rolling out these tiny little plaster humanoids. And I saw some people kind of push back on this idea that it's all fake, especially it was Clint Ehrlich who wrote this really long Twitter thread, which seemed to give the story more legs. He said, look, most people think the alien bodies shown to Mexico's Congress were fake, but I have the reports from an international team of scientists. You need to read their findings. They say all the aliens are real. So he goes through this big thread pointing out how the specimens were found in a mine in Peru. This is the original source.
Mm-hmm.
Radiocarbon dating indicates they're at least 1,000 years old. But evidence presented to the Congress of Peru goes much further than that. He said sophisticated DNA testing was performed on the alien species by an international consortium. The results were presented by geneticist Salvador Romero, who was trained at UNAM, Mexico's equivalent to MIT. He compared DNA samples from the aliens to a database of known DNA sequences on Earth. 70% of the DNA sequences were completely unknown. It's a never before seen in any living organism on Earth. And he's just going post by post. He mentions the forensic pathologist they use, Benitez, who investigated whether the specimens could be a hoax. He found no evidence of this. He said the body developed naturally. It had a functional anatomy. He drew attention to the natural displacement of vertebrae in a pregnant specimen with eggs. He said this could be related to the normal physiological response to gestation, and said it would be difficult to reproduce in such a harmonious way.
No, it wouldn't.
And this just goes on and on. He's talking about the ligaments and the tendons, how they're all connected, how you would expect them to be. These findings were corroborated by a team from St. Petersburg Medical University. This is my favorite part. The number 3 medical school in Russia.
So like the number 40th in the world.
Professor Galetsky from there identified numerous physiological differences that confirmed these specimens were not human. Their anatomy is completely different from anything found on Earth. And then we get to, where's my favorite guy? This Russian guy at the end. I mean, he just goes through all of this talking about the way the skull is shaped, the, you know, the tendons. And then we get to this guy. Here he is, Dr. Korotkov.
Isn't that the same guy in the documentary from before?
Yeah. And he's a professor of biophysics at IMTO University in St. Petersburg, allegedly. I found some audio of him today in an interview where he describes some of his background, and it's kind of fascinating. Let's take a listen.
My background was quantum physicist in the Soviet Union, in Leningrad, as quantum physicist. And that's why I was involved in the university, in different institutions with laser physics, plasma physics, cosmic physics, optics, so different fields related to quantum physics. I met one of my old friends. Do you want to be involved in a very interesting project? Okay, tell me. Okay, this is total secret, so you need to promise me that it will be just between us. The project was to create the system of telepathy communication, submarines and satellites. I became the deputy director of this laboratory, and we had unlimited funding, unlimited. We was able to buy any equipment we need. After in 2 years, we were able to find out conditions for telepathy communication between people.
Really?
And later on, I developed approach between person and technical systems, different sensors. So I developed a set of sensors that respond to human intention.
So this guy claims, because the audio is a bit dodgy.
Let me try. Did he develop some type of telepathic communication system, but also computer sensors that would be able to respond to telepathic signals sent out from humans?
Yes. Yeah, he claimed he was working with the Soviets, so he was a Soviet scientist, a quantum physicist, and he was approached by someone higher up who said, you got to work on this secret project with us. And it was essentially to get submarines to talk telepathically with satellites.
Yeah, but we know those stories. Like, yeah. There's that, you can't, like, I wonder if he's just grabbed that story. Remember the horrible stories about, like, the experiments that he did with rabbits?
Yeah.
You know, like,
so it's intriguing he's using that as, you know, his background. But the problem is there's no proof that this guy is from St. Petersburg University. He's not on faculty list. People have contacted the university. They've got no knowledge of him. When you look, it sounds like the guy is just making it all up. Mm-hmm. And when you go to his website, he's spruiking this thing called the BioWell 3.0, which is this
$200
weird Kirlian,
almost $2,300.
It's this weird Kirlian camera. Like, he calls it a GDV camera. You pay over $2,000 for the camera. Then you've got to buy this subscription software. And everywhere on the website, I was looking for examples of where you can actually see the images it produces. And then I realized, no, you've got to subscribe to, you got to get a subscription plan to this software. And it just produces this kind of graphic printout of what this device does. So he's spruiking this energy photographing device, which might work. It might be interesting. I'm not saying that these things aren't possible, but it's all getting a little bit suspicious when you go to the main page here. And it says, you know, he's a biophysicist at St. Petersburg University, senior researcher at St. Petersburg Research Institute. And again, no evidence of him being involved. And then he links to over 400 papers that he's published. You click on that and it's immediately a 404. But if you look at the domain, like, I'll just get rid of the end of the URL, it's his website. It's like, it's all his website.
You put his name, though, into Google Scholar, and that would reveal whether or not he's published papers.
Yeah, there's nothing.
Well, if you're making pretty outrageous claims,
it's a little bit suspicious. One of the other biologists they were rolling out, who's apparently verifying all of these, there's no mention of him at the institute he supposedly works at. They're denying that he even works there. He's supposed to be this world-renowned expert. He has one publication under his name. The whole thing stinks. And if it wasn't bleedingly obvious when you saw these things, I mean, it would be more convincing if it was this. If it had Biden's head on.
You had to go at me, right? But I'm like, I think I know what's going on here. Yeah, I'm more convinced. I don't care if people think I'm a conspiracy theorist. There's a lot of mess going on in politics globally at the moment. A huge mess is going on. And, you know, the peasants are getting restless.
Oh, here we go.
The peasants are getting restless. And all of a sudden, there's an impeachment inquiry going on with the leader of the free world. I know. Let's generate a circus. Bring in the papier-mâché aliens.
Okay.
And that will distract people.
Let's just play out the thinking with your conspiracy here. So Jaime Massan, right, who's been peddling these fake mummified aliens for 6 years. What does he get a call? Does the deep state call Jaime Massan and go, Jaime, we need your help? He's like,
no, yeah, it doesn't.
Anything, my friends.
No, it doesn't work that way.
I want 2 million pesos. When I will roll out the aliens for you. Is that your scenario?
No, when I asked before, how did they get an audience with all these politicians? They're pulling the strings in the
background.
It's
Mexico.
What's that
got to do with politics in the United States?
I don't know. I just find it that, well, look what's happened. Everyone's distracted by it.
No, they're not.
They're distracted by it.
It was in the news for a day and then people debunked
globally.
It. And now basically every single news report you see is a debunking. If you want to see why this is ridiculous, and I think this is probably the best explanation of it, is that, for example, the arms of this thing, they're femurs. They're all kind of mismatched bones, mm-hmm. from different sources. Here's a source I found. I can't remember the name of this, but I found this on YouTube where essentially they're explaining why this is nonsense. Let's take a listen.
What do we see? Same stuff. A hodgepodge of human and animal bones. Here's a mummy named Josephine. A real beauty. Instead of humeri, she sports femurs or thigh bones. Her legs are even more baffling. One of the thigh bones is actually a femur, only facing the wrong way around, while the other one is a tibia. And they are completely mismatched. With the hip bone, there's no joint there at all. The poor humanoid wouldn't have made a single step. Some of the bones are simply chopped off. Note this asymmetry here. The fingers are a total mess too. The first pseudophalanges are facing in different directions on her left and right hands, with the white part facing up or down. Well, they just forgot to turn them the right way. Stuff happens. Go. And look at this alien head. French paleontologist Julien Benoit thinks that those who crafted the small humanoid mummies used skulls of some small mammals for their heads, such as a llama or alpaca. Comparison shows that the reptiloid's cranial cavity fits perfectly the cranial cavity of a llama. The location of the olfactory bulbs, the inner ear...
So basically, it's a llama skull turned around. And you see the experts in Masson's video to the Mexican Congress where they're explaining, like, if you look at the eyes, they're different to ours. It doesn't have the right nasal cavities. That's because you're looking at the back of a skull.
Why do people want to so strongly believe this? Why do people?
I guess people want to believe it.
Why?
It is interesting that this has followed all the revelations from whistleblowers about UFOs, and then this nonsense gets drolled out again. That is intriguing, I got to say.
Well, the thing is, when I was making my, I was half earnest in my conspiracy theory there. The thing is, though, around the same time, NASA has just released a 33-page report describing how they're going to continue looking into UFOs. Right? So it's like,
what's that got to do with anything?
I just find it that at the moment, like the whole narrative, there's this UAP narrative that's being pushed. And I know that you already know this, but I don't buy it. I just do not buy it that there's been such a significant cover-up for decades and decades and decades. And now all of a sudden, you've got Grush coming out. People have been murdered. People, and yet Grush isn't. Like, people are allowed to come forward and just talk about all this stuff. And you've got all this. It's like, I feel like it's a distraction.
Well, the mummies are ridiculous. I think we can all agree on that. And people have been asking, what do you guys think? I think it's hilarious that after all this time, after 6 years of being thoroughly debunked the first time, he gets an audience in front of the Mexican Congress. And if you watch the original, which I don't have footage of, but they're in two giant wooden cases. And there's this big fanfare of him pulling off the the cover and revealing these stupid looking creatures. It is so dumb and hilarious.
You know what will be next? It'll be the Greer humanoid.
Yeah, something like that. But what's intriguing about this story is it all traces back to this guy named Mario, this mysterious character named Mario in Peru. You see, Jaime Masson and his team and the people at Gaia, they have to go through these middlemen to get access to these mummies. They didn't find the mummies themselves. They were found by this guy named Mario.
And deep state. He's deep state. They drop off mummies to unwitting researchers.
Well, they're tomb robbers. These guys are criminals. They're tomb robbers in Peru. And there was an article over at Live Science in 2018 where they were looking into this. And these tomb robbers in Peru, they go through the Nazca region and they try and find these mummies because they know that they can sell them to private collectors. And apparently one of these looters, the head of this looting group, his name's Mario. That's who Jaime Masson and his colleagues pay. That's who Gaia pays to get access to these mummies. So the idea is this guy, this delinquent treasure hunter who's been known by police in the area for over 20 years, he's been doing this for decades. This is his main racket. He perhaps found some mummies. Obviously, they find real mummies in the Nazca Plains.
Sure.
And they've just taken bits and pieces and joined it together.
What's that old adage that there's no honor amongst thieves? So all of a sudden, a guy who's been robbing graves for 20 years is going to turn around and be like, oh, no, this is definitely real.
Yeah, and the reason you're getting dating results from the DNA that's showing these mummies are over 1,000 years old is because pieces of them are over 1,000 years old.
Are they getting DNA? Is that what they're doing the carbon dating for?
That's what they're claiming, that they're dating elements of the mummies and they're over 1,000 years old.
Yeah, right. But wouldn't this is one good point, though. I mean, I heard in that documentary what they said 70% of it is not in any genetic database that we have. But what is in the genetic? If there's 30%, what's that 30%? Is that 30% llama?
Yeah, probably.
Is that what, they don't say, right? You've got to listen to what they don't say. So what's the 30% that was matched?
Yeah, I don't know.
If it was alien, if it was extraterrestrial, zero should be the match.
Peru's had this grave robbing problem for decades now. Yeah. I found this article I'll put in the show notes from the New York Times. So they're interviewing some local archaeological expert who said, look, We've had all these finds that everything appears on the black market. We have stuff showing up in America and it's robbed from these tombs in the Nazca Plains in Peru. It's a big black market operation. And he points out that the police used to fight it quite effectively until the 90s. They had a problem with leftist guerrillas in the region. And so the police were like fighting the leftist guerrillas. So this black market for mummies just really took off.
Who could possibly want those though? Like, why do they?
Private collectors. A lot of this stuff would just end up in private collections. But again, it's just funny. This gets rolled out. It hits the headlines. How it made the Mexican Congress.
How, it's just Ben?
Embarrassing. It's so embarrassing. But my favorite, because, you know, they're talking about these experts confirming this and scientists confirming that. My favorite example of the experts getting it wrong this week came from Ireland. I don't know if you saw this week, Aaron, but there's this video I saw on social media.
Oh, not the asteroid on the beach.
Yeah, let's take a look. This guy digging a hole. So this is two men on a beach in Ireland. There's one guy in there with a child's shovel doing what guys do, digging a hole on the beach, digging this massive hole on the beach. And it was a very impressive beach hole. Mm. A lot of people standing around watching this perfectly nice circumference hole. And then the next day in Dublin, there was a news report from Virgin Media. Let's take a listen.
Well, Colette, this is the crater that stopped Dave Kennedy in his tracks yesterday when, as you say, he was walking his beach here along Portmarnock Beach in Dublin. We're joined by Dave now. Dave, tell us, what was your reaction when you came across this?
Complete shock, to be honest. I was walking along just with the dog and came across the impact site. Fortunately enough, I love space and exploration and astrophysics, so I was a bit surprised when I saw it, but I knew immediately that it was an impact site. And then lo and behold, right in the middle of it was the rock.
Tell us about this rock. What about it made you think that this has to be a meteor strike?
So I noticed by the way it came in and where it was landed, it had created the big mound around. So that was everything from the inside that was blown out. But it's just the actual weight of it and its density. You're definitely going to have to get a check to see what it's made of.
And tell us about the markings on it.
So across here, you can actually see the way it's just scoring.
This has got to be a joke, right? Like this whole setup, the guy claiming that he's an expert and the angle the rock fell and he starts talking about scorch marks. It's the whole thing's got to be a setup.
I reckon, yeah, the Irish are hard to read. So I don't know whether or not, like, surely you can't be that dumb that you come across this because there's no rock there either. Well, so he must be lying about the rock.
I found this article from the Irish Mirror kind of making fun of Virgin Media for the report. So it at least looks like the media is taking it seriously, that there was this issue, like there was this confounding mix-up where they thought this hole dug at the beach was actually some kind of extraterrestrial impact. And if you look at the end of the article, they say this astrophysics buff that we saw in the video there, David Kennedy, it said, today he is disappointed, but he says he is getting the rock analyzed in the hopes it wasn't a completely fruitless discovery.
I don't believe that, though, because analysis of, you know, rocks, I mean, yeah, it's not that it's expensive, but it would take a little bit of money. Like, why would you be running with the joke that hard?
The whole thing sounds like a wind-up.
I reckon it is, to show how stupid the media is.
I found this, the Instagram page of the original guys, and they were acting like the whole thing was hilarious.
Yeah, of course it is.
They just, you know, they just dug this hole and the next day they saw this news report. So I'm not sure what to believe. Speaking of Mexico, though, I wanted to point one last thing your way before we go into your segment, Aaron. Mm. There's this fantastic new work that's appeared from a Dutch digital artist. His name's Thomas Cole. He's published a detailed recreation of the Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan from the 16th century. Have you seen this?
No, I haven't.
This is unbelievable. This took over 1.5 years of work. And essentially what he and his team did, they did aerial photography of Mexico City. And then they painstakingly created digital recreations of what the city would have looked like.
It's in spectacular.
Like the 1500s. Mm. And every image is hyper detailed. They've got images of the temples, the full layout of the city. It's got different weather conditions. You see the grid layout of this ancient city. It's really mind blowing. I'll link to this in the show notes where they're showing the architecture and the temples. My favorite image is this one here where they've recreated what it would look like from like a wide-angle GoPro lens, which just looks amazing.
And is that a temple? Is that like a main temple, is it?
Yeah, that's the temple of Montezuma. They've got the market square there. And if you scroll down to the end of the page, there's a slider so that you can see Mexico City today and what it would have looked like in 1518. It's really impressive. I would love to see more stuff like this all around the world where you get these real convincing digital recreations. And that you can see the old square is there. Mm. And imagine, you know, going to that place in Mexico City and just thinking, you know, this square's been here for hundreds and hundreds, nearly 1,000 years. There's been some kind of square here. It's quite amazing. So I'll link to that in the show notes. That's from Thomas Cole. The URL is tenochtitlan.thomascole.nl.
Potentially more exciting, though, is our, you know, because it hasn't really taken off. Like the whole virtual reality, augmented reality stuff hasn't really taken off. But it might, you know, with Apple releasing this device if it comes down in price. But it would be amazing to apply that kind of, you know, artistry to virtual reality. Imagine being able to walk around one of these ancient squares.
That would be cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, one of the great applications of VR, being able to do this kind of time-traveling tourism, which is, you know, almost impossible to do.
It would cause problems, though, because it wouldn't be diverse enough.
Oh, yeah, there's all that crap that will happen. if it's bought out by Netflix, we know what's going to happen. Did you see that about that Danish film that's coming up from the 1500s?
What's that?
I can't remember his name.
Oh, with, what's his name, Mikkelsen?
Yeah, yeah. It's in Denmark, set in the 1500s, and they were concerned about diversity.
Yeah, the journalist was asking why the film is not diverse when it's just full of Danes.
But Parasite wasn't diverse, and
What's Parasite?
Parasite was a South Korean film.
That was diverse. It had Koreans and aliens in it.
Well, there you go. If every historical film has aliens in it now, you might be okay.
Dude, my parents have just been watching Korean TV nonstop. Like my mom and my dad, who are in their 60s. And I'm like, why are you guys watching so much Korean TV? And they say, because it doesn't have any of that woke nonsense.
Yeah.
Like men act like men.
Yeah.
Women act like women. And it just doesn't have any of this race stuff. It's just like you get to watch a good show with a good storyline.
But that's all well and good, right? If you want to put that stuff into things, fine. But overall, I feel like it's just packed in for the sake of it. It's not actually helping anyone. It's not actually trying. It's just shoved in.
It's tiresome. So tiresome.
Oh, I saw an ad from Apple recently where Apple is like talking to Mother Nature, and they get Mother Nature in and they go, well, Apple is trying to permanently remove carbon from the atmosphere.
Oh, I'm like, God.
Do you realize that would kill everyone on Earth?
That's what we need, a carbon-free atmosphere.
Criminals. But anyway, I digress.
Is a bit of a digression.
Let's talk about these Threshold experiences. So this is Threshold. This is by Alexander Bethany. And this is Terminal Lucidity and the Border of Life and Death. And he's done a really great job with this book because, as I pointed out earlier on, he's obviously put out there, you know, stories of end-of-life experiences, and there's like basically four kind of levels of experiences that people have. You have the people will see passed-over loved ones. You'll have some kind of guide that will come through. You'll have people that are like waiting for a train or a plane or something like that. And then you'll have these terminal lucidity experiences where people who have been suffering from dementia or other brain-related or, you know, neurological problems will all of a sudden have a return, like they will come back to their body. And before we go into those experiences, though, I want to play some audio for you because some of the people that are at the coalface of these experiences are actually hospice nurses, and they're reluctant to describe their stories only until recently. When I say recently, the last 20 or 30 years, where they've all had experiences. Like if you talk off the record to a hospice nurse, I think you'll find a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them will say something weird's happened, something unusual happened, you know, I'm not so sure. But here I've got a collection of reports of hospice nurses who have just, it's obviously a very difficult role to be in. Like it's, you know, you really are helping people through death. You're acting as not just a carer, but also almost like a death doula. And I don't have any of the names of these people. They don't want to, you know, present their names, but I will link to the full documentary so you can watch it for yourself.
What's the documentary?
It's just a collection of hospice nurses talking about their experiences and a near-death experience TV show. It was like just a clip that's taken out.
Oh, okay.
So, but I want to start, though, with this woman who started working in the field, and she wasn't sure what to do. And it wasn't just the experience that she had, but it actually pushed her to remain in the field. Take a listen.
By working with the dying, hospice nurses gain an insight into death and the opportunity to witness the signs of a life beyond our own.
I had one gentleman 3 months after I started working in hospice. I thought, I can't do this anymore. This is just too much. I'm going to get burned out, or it's just too stressful. And so just as I was really trying to debate whether I was going to leave this field or not, I had an experience that just kind of blew me away. And one of the LPNs came up to me and said, Mr. So-and-so just died. And so I took that information and we said, all right, we'll call a physician and call a coroner and get all the information that we need. And I was walking down the hall making bed checks and sure everybody was okay. And this one old fellow was climbing out of bed. He was really out of pain control. And I was thinking, you know, we need to just get him settled down. And I walked into the room and I said, let me help you get taken care of. And he said, I got to get out of here. And I said, I understand, you know. And he said, I have to die. And I said, you know, I would probably want to die too if I had that much pain. And let me help you. Let me see what we can do. He said, no, you don't understand. He said, I have to die. And I said, well, I don't know where it came from. And I said, well, you have to wait till you get your own invitation. Sometimes it just because we want to die doesn't mean we get to die. We have to wait until. Well, that guy down there just got his invitation. He said, I knew him from Lyman. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, he just shuffled by here. And he points from his door to the window and how it crossed in front of his bed. And I thought, boy, there's a lot I don't know yet.
So she herself is experiencing a crisis after a few months in, whether or not she can stay. And then she has this experience, which is amazing, that this guy sees his friend from school. So it's not described there as being school, but it was from school. So right. From decades ago.
An old friend.
Who is dead and sees him walk through the room and out through the window. And he's like, I've got to go. I've got to chase after my friend. So it, you know, this is the incredible kind of stuff that's reported by people that demonstrates that there may be more going on here than we certainly realize. Then there's even like sadder stories. I mean, it's one thing for an elderly person to pass away. It's still sad, but they have had a long life.
Clip just says horse.
Horse. This is quite sad because it's about a young boy who is, you know, suffering from some type of terminal illness. But one thing that happens for a lot of people is they have precognitive dreams or dreams in some type of archetype that is coming to collect them. And in this particular story, this nurse describes a young boy that she was, you know, caring for who had this entity come, but it got stopped by a waterway. Take a listen.
I had a kid that I lost last week, but he saw a horse. And his dream was about 2 weeks before he died. He was on this big brown horse. And they were going through the field, and it was very smooth. It wasn't like a gallop, but they weren't flying. And he said that all of a sudden they kind of jumped over a barrier, and when they landed in a riverbank that had overflowed its beds. And it stopped. The horse stopped and turned sideways, waiting for this kid to tell him which way to go, whether to go into the woods or out of the woods. And I asked him which way he chose, and he said, well, we went out. And I said, what do you think would have happened if you'd gone into the woods? He said, I think I'd have been gone. And I told him I thought he would too. And I told him that horse would probably come back for him. When it was time for him to go, that horse would be the one to come back. Well, that afternoon, his mom was washing dishes, and the horse came. And she went to talk to him. And she asked David if his horse was there, and he said yes. And she said, I think he's probably here to get you. And she said, I think so too. And within 2 hours, he had gone.
Gee, that's sad.
It's extremely sad. But, I mean, it shows you that particular nurse has obviously had enough of these experiences where she was able to, you know, essentially provide some comfort to this child to be like, well, when that horse comes back, you know, it's probably going to, you know, help you cross over. Like, it's amazing when you hear stories like that. Then you have more incredible types of experiences. And this relates to a woman that was referred to as Grandma Rose, but essentially it was this young woman who was in her 50s and she was suffering from a neurodegenerative condition and she didn't want her mother to find out, but she's insisting that her mother not know about it. Her mother was in her 90s. And regardless, some type of spirit, if you will, or entity steps in to make sure that she does find out.
We would say he was unresponsive.
Oh, this is Rose?
Yeah, Rose, please.
She had Lou Gehrig's disease. And
it was getting pretty bad. She was pretty close to death, and the muscles in her throat were closing up. They weren't working very well, and she had this fear that she was going to drown, which is essentially was a real possibility for her. And one of her last wish was that her mother not be told. Her mother was 90 years old, and her mother, she liked to be called Grandma Rose, and she just said, this is too hard for a mother to go through, to watch a child die, and especially the way I'm dying. I don't want my mother to know. Now, the family was in conflict with this, but it was her last wish, so what could they do? And then the story, as Grandma Rose tells me, is she lived in Texas, and one night she went to bed. She was getting into bed, and she saw her husband standing there. And her husband had been dead for 20 years. But she says that he was as real to her as I am to you. And he said, Rose, I've come to take Mary home. And at that point, Grandma Rose, she just started to scream and said, no, no, please, let me go back and hold my baby one more time. Don't take her until I've gone and I've held her and I've said goodbye and I've kissed her. Please don't do that. And so he just kind of smiled and faded away. And she knew at that point that he would allow that. So she got on the next plane and she came to Denver. And for 3 days, she stayed with her daughter. And she told her stories, and she combed her hair, and she gave her bath, and she was holding her daughter when she died, and I was there, and she just looked at me, and she said, you know, I brought her into the world, and it's only right that I'm with her when she goes out. And that would have never happened if Mary's husband wouldn't have come to her and told her that he was taking her home.
So this crosses into some of the more extreme ELE-style cases, end-of-life experiences. This woman was in her 90s, and she had no understanding, no idea that her daughter was that ill and on the precipice of death. And yet her daughter didn't want her to know, and somehow her husband, who has been deceased for a long time, comes through and warns her. But then there's enough timing as well. Now, some people have interpreted this, and I've seen this particular story before, and the idea was is that, well, maybe it wasn't like a spirit that came through. Maybe it was some telepathy, and the telepathy manifested as a knowing. And I'm like, come on, there's too many of these stories of people experiencing encounters with loved ones at the point of death that suggest to me that it is some type of external agency. It's not something which is being generated by your mind, something which even comes down to telepathy, something like, which is still, you know, super normal. There's something else. There's something more, you know, esoteric, metaphysical, which is occurring. So that leads us into the next level of, you know, and this is only a short one, but this is a man that was basically in a really bad way. He was completely messed up. This is what starts crossing into the terminal lucidity kind of stuff. Because his brain had been destroyed, whether it was through dementia or, but there was a physical destruction of his brain. The guy was near catatonic. He was unable to move. He was unable to respond. They'd just given him a bath and pushing
this
him.
Guy?
Yeah. And we're pushing him back through the ward. And as they pushed him back through the ward, something incredible happened.
So this is number four.
Yeah, four, please.
We would say he was unresponsive. And as we were walking down the hall, pushing his bed down the hall, he opened his eyes and he looked straight up and his little toothless mouth, and he went and waved and then just smiled and closed his eyes, and 5 minutes later he was gone. I don't know who he was waving at, but that's not uncommon.
It's only short, and it's not uncommon. There's so many of these stories, but in that particular one, he was in such a bad way that how could he have done that? Like, how could he have been able to even have the recognition of something else? And then you cross into the more extreme example, which really is a terminal lucidity, same kind of thing, of a guy that, you know, is unable to move his muscles. He's completely unable to move his muscles, but then something incredible seemingly happens.
You feel a presence. You feel something is in the room. You know that there's something there. And one time there was this man, and he was really, really close to death. He was very, very weak. And he looked up, and he was looking at something, and he looked very, very scared. And the nurse said to him, it's okay. They're there to help you. They won't hurt you. And he put his hand up, and he had his hand up like somebody was holding it. And he did this for a few minutes, and there is no way this man had the strength to hold his hand up by himself. And he died just a few minutes later, too.
And a lot of hospice workers have described that. These people that have no ability to hold themselves, but they will. They'll hug. Like, they'll reach up, but they'll hug. They have no ability to do that, and yet somehow they do.
Isn't this the sudden burst of lucidity and strength that occurs before death?
It is, but it's like what people like endocrinologists have suggested is that it's a release of a hormone, which is, you know, all your, for some reason, all of our organs have it. And as we go into a shutting down state, it releases this hormone. And then all of a sudden someone, I'm like, well, then why do they always reach up? Like, what's the reaching up for? Or why do they behave a certain fashion? And even if you're capable of causing the muscle tissue to be able to contract to that point, what about the people whose brains have been physically destroyed, absolutely physically destroyed?
Yes, the people with heads full of fluid.
Well, yeah. So let's cross into some of those experiences. So I want to go actually to an old paper by Michael Nam. This was published in the Journal of Near-Death Studies in Terminal Lucidity. This was published back in 2009. And, you know, he's quite fascinating in the fact that he points out that, look, in the age of Romanticism in Germany, there were many authors that were dissatisfied with the Age of Enlightenment, and they wanted to re-emphasize the night side of nature. You know, this is a topic that we've looked into. And basically what it was is that people wanted to, you know, show and demonstrate that the soul is more than a byproduct of brain chemistry. And this is a notion at the time that was gaining, you know, increasing importance among scientists. And look what's happened. You know, this is the 1800s that this has happened. And now look where we are now. Like, if you were to go and suggest spiritualism, non-local consciousness, inorganic non-local consciousness, anything like that in a modern scientific medical setting, you would be shot down immediately.
Well, even with the work I'm going to be covering from Langer and the PLUS Extension coming up, she's doing these experiments that are showing it's the mind is the cause of this physiological reaction. But when she presents her papers, the questions she always gets from her peers is along the lines of, yes, but what's the mechanism?
Yeah, yeah.
But what's actually going on? Yes, it's the mind, but tell us, what's the actual mechanism? Like, they're constantly searching for the neurons doing this.
Yeah, yes.
Or the brain, brain doing that.
Yeah.
The explanation that, no, it's the mind. It's the consciousness. It's like they can't wrap their head around it. It's never enough. It's never enough to say, it's the mind that creates this effect. It has to be something else. It has to be a chemical released or a hormone or this part of the brain is doing that. And you can just feel the frustration, you know, when you've got experiment after experiment after experiment showing this connection between mind and body, and yet still this old paradigm of, yeah, but what's actually going on?
Well, there's a great example of that was highlighted where they did conduct autopsies, you know, obviously into, you know, a lot of these patients that had displayed these terminal lucidity events where all of a sudden it's like the old ego, the old person had come back. And it's quite, you know, it's repeated in many of these stories and it's quite sad. Like, it's so horrible for people to, you know, go through, you know, watching a loved one suffer from dementia because they describe that the person that they knew actually dies years before their body dies. And this is why these particular cases of terminal lucidity are so amazing, is because just briefly, and with terminal lucidity, it's like 80% of the cases, they kind of occur just hours before death, you know, and this is a recurring thing. Sometimes they occur a week before, you know, sometimes a little bit longer, but the reality is most of them looking at these studies occur within, you know, 80% of the time within a few days. But what was described is that, you know, there was this one woman who was suffering from, you know, a dementia once again, and her brainstem was being eviscerated. And I don't actually know, she was suffering from a brain tumor. And something I got to really point out as well, brain tumor will lead to a dementia-like state. But with the brain, this is what's really incredible about this, is that the brain itself, if you think you get a tumor, right, people go, oh, well, then it just pushes the brain out of the way. No, the cells, the carcinogenic cells essentially eat and destroy the other tissue. They consume it to provide for themselves. Like, a cancer really is, you know, like a foreign agent inside your body ultimately, even though it's using your cells, it's consuming everything. And with these cancers, like the cells get, you know, or the clumps get bigger and bigger and bigger, and they destroy everything else. So the person that you are in that, your brain, it's gone. Like, it's absolutely gone. And this, so this woman, I think she was only a relatively young woman, like maybe in her 50s, suffering from brain cancer, getting worse and getting worse and getting worse. Her, you know, character, her personality disappearing more and more each and every day, to the point where she's gone. She's still, you know, on machines and hooked up and hanging around, but she's gone. Until one particular day, she just gets up. And what in this particular report, I think it was like they would every night, the hospice or whoever it was, the medical setting, would call the family and say, just letting you know that, you know, your mother is still, you know, and this is what they do when, people are at the point of death. They try to kind of give you, I shouldn't say it's false hope, they're just being nice, but they'll call you and give you an update, yeah, yeah. You know, and be like, yeah, she's resting peacefully, that kind of thing. Well, they would do this over 2 nights. On the third night, they're calling like, your mother's awake, like she's sitting up. She's drinking champagne. Like she was drinking champagne and just relaxed. And it was because it was her birthday. Like,
oh my God.
She died the next day. So it's like, how does the, and if she was
so back, completely comatose.
Completely comatose.
Brain being
eaten away and destroyed.
She's basically a veggie. And then she just has one last hurrah where she's drinking champagne. Yep. Did she get up and have a waltz as well?
Well, she was just sitting up with the family, apparently. She was sitting up drinking champagne and she was back. And it's so, in some way, it's like a, It's a dichotomy because it's so wonderful. It's so beautiful to have this person back, but then they're taken from you so quickly. You know, it's cruel in another way. But people obviously, when they've spoken to about, you know, the families who've had these experiences, they describe it as being, well, at least I got that gift. Like the person came back. Another example was of this Navy captain, or a former Navy captain, and he was suffering from a severe brain injury. And as his brain injury got worse and worse and worse, the guy obviously deteriorated. He went into a, you know, a completely destroyed state. And the guy became, I think he became agitated or violent, but just before he passed away, he had this terminal lucidity experience where he came back. He came back totally normal, right? And he got to talk to his friends. And I think in that particular circumstance, he came back because he had a bunch of books that he'd taken out from a library.
Yeah, that's right.
And he had to get them back. And he had to tell people where to go and what he wanted to do. He had to get his affairs in order. And then he died. Now, they did an autopsy on his brain. Well, they did his whole body, like post-mortem. But on his brain, they found that his brain had been flushed like it was this water, essentially.
There's
nothing there. It was water. And this is what's been reported in other cases. It was a case that was done, I think, in the early 1900s of a guy who had gone into an asylum. And this asylum, you know, this lead of the asylum had seen this in numerous cases of people that, you know, they're a mess. Like they've become, you know, completely deranged. And this particular asylum calls up this brother and says, look, our patient, your brother, he's back. Like he's just, and he's like, what are you talking about? How is he back? And he says, he's back. Like he wants to talk to you. So the brother races to the asylum and he goes and talks to his brother and they resolve whatever they have to resolve and it's all wonderful. The guy dies the next day. Now, this is quite horrible, but when they do the autopsy, they find that his brain tissue has essentially been completely replaced with pus.
What?
His brain was pus. That's all it was.
What do you mean it's just pus? Pus.
All the brain tissue, the neural tissue, gray matter, white matter, all destroyed. It was pus. He was just a head full of pus. That's all he was. So no neurons, no pathways, essentially no brain stem. So even just the function of you being able to sit up, let alone talk, let alone have your own personality come back, suggests that this goes even beyond the idea of non-local consciousness. It's something even more complex than that.
They're such weird cases because obviously there's a plethora of evidence that shows that damaging the brain does affect the personality.
Absolutely.
It does damage the personality. People change. You know, we see this from concussion injuries, you know, sportsmen that play impact sports like rugby here in Australia or NFL, they have serious behavioral issues and, you know, they...
Violence. Normally it reverts to violence.
Yeah, start to break down later in life. So obviously there's an understanding of that, but these cases, they don't cause you to question everything we know about the brain, but obviously we don't have the full picture. Obviously, consciousness doesn't 100% rely on the meat in your skull to be able to function.
Exactly. And you know, and you pointed out with hydrocephaly, that's one example where people just have massive amounts. So where some of the idea that there's like a releasable hormone of some kind is that there was a particular experience of a guy that, you know, had all this typical terminal lucidity kind of experiences, brainstem destroyed, everything else. When they did the autopsy on him, they found that his brain had been kind of coated in some type of orange-coloured liquid of some kind. And they suspected that this was the chemical that had somehow been released in the blood, which had caused, but it's only one, you know, anecdotal report that comes from. But then, yeah, you're right. It starts crossing into the idea that, well, if it's not the brain, like if the brain tissue has been completely destroyed, what's acting as the receiver? You know, what actually is the receiver of consciousness? And where do people go? Like, do you step out into another reality when you're somewhere and you just come back because, oh, well, like, do people discard their body? And then it crosses into more crazy things like the idea of spirit possession, which I pointed out at the start of the show, where people actually start fighting a spirit of some kind. And for whatever reason, they prevent it from fully coming through, but it just leaves them as a husk. And so they have to wait for their body to expire, and then they come back at the final moment to say goodbye to the family.
And they're the kind of stories you've got coming up in our Plus extension of people getting killed by their photocopiers, one man getting eaten alive by a supercomputer.
I like the segue that you set up for me there, Ben, because that's exactly where we're going. Because obviously, if you don't, if it's non-biological, if it's not your brain, if that's not acting as the filter and the consciousness is coming from somewhere else, that explains panpsychism, animism, haunted objects, killer cars, killer photocopiers, killer Cabbage Patch Dolls, all of that is coming up in our Plus extension right after this.
Also in Plus, I'm going to be looking at The Mindful Body, Thinking Our Way to Chronic Health by Ellen Langer, with the experiment of sending Italians back in time to the 1980s to see what happens. You know, whether they get stronger. Do you get stronger if you get sent back to the 1980s? I like this idea.
I like that idea.
I think I might redo my house to the 90s. Just have this 90s decor, paint everything beige.
Please don't.
Just have this everything 90s television shows.
You know what?
How would that not be better than what's going on now?
Kind of where I am with TV shows.
90s TV, 90s music, everything. The whole house is just 90s, 90s clothes.
Yeah, but if you bring back your Nokia 5110, is that going to turn you around and make you younger as well?
How is that bad? Then I won't be obsessed with apps and looking at your phone all the time.
Good point.
Just going back to that golden age of the 90s.
Yeah, the 90s were pretty good.
You actually... you know, you go back to your younger self. We've got that research coming up. She also has this fascinating experiment I can't wait to tell you about, which explores the idea of something being in the air.
What do you mean in the air? Like a contaminant?
Yes, that mindfulness is contagious. So there's an experiment set up where they see what happens when groups of experiment participants enter a room that A, nothing's happened. No one's been in there. Enter a room where B, people have been shown horrific videos of tsunamis killing people and road traffic accidents and a kidney operation.
Yeah.
And C, a room where people have been meditating for an hour.
I wonder what would happen if we showed them the last Plus extension.
Yeah, it's the science of the vibes in the air. We're going to be talking about that coming up in Plus. To get access, head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. All the details are there. You get access to the big extensions we do on these shows every single week. Plus members also get an entirely ad-free version of the show. Sign up for MU Max and you get access to our entire back catalogue going back 15 plus years of shows. And of course, Plus members also get, what else did I say? A higher bitrate feed as well. So you're getting a better quality show if you sign up for Plus, along with these massive extensions we do every single Friday. Sign up today, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. That's a wrap for this show. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Welcome back to your Plus extension. Great to have you with us. Do you like the new titles?